Welcome to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. This program is produced in association with KQED Public Radio and the Aspen Institute. I'm Jane Wales, your host. Protests have proliferated and movements have been created almost overnight, and they are often formed without leaders, and yet they're transforming the civic landscape and they're affecting lasting change. Joining us to discuss the power of protest is Richard Youngs. He's a senior fellow at Carnegie Europe and author of the new book, Civic Action Unleashed, New Hope or False Dawn for Democracy. Moderating this program is my co-host, Ray Suarez. This broadcast is made possible each week by the generous support of Chevron, TPG, and the Draper Richards Kaplan Foundation.
Richard Youngs, protest is a very old method of people speaking to the powerful. But what's happening now? Why do so many people in so many places think no one's listening to them otherwise?
It is a very old method, but it's becoming a lot more widespread. So there have been protests in the US on and off over recent years, but this is something happening across the world. Just in recent days, we've seen very dramatic events in Sudan and Algeria where thousands of people have been on the streets and have been strong enough to drive presidents out of office, presidents that had been in power for over 30 years. And you could look more widely across the world in France and Hungary, Venezuela, Thailand, and we're seeing really large-scale protests taking place on a much more regular basis. So what we're seeing in the United States isn't specific to the US. This is really something happening around the world. And it's happening for a number of reasons. Clearly, citizens are more disillusioned with their governments. They're more disillusioned with political parties and the mainstream channels of political representation. So they feel they're being forced out onto the street because governments simply aren't responsive to their demands. Some of their demands are economic, some are political. In non-democratic countries around the world, they're also dealing with increased repression, which is really angering them and making them feel they have to take to the streets to get their demands heard.
Well, I want to tease apart whether it's feelings or something that's actually measurable. Is there, in fact, a sort of almost paradoxical relationship between the resort to the streets and the fact that millions more people today, tens of millions more people today, are living under governments that are far more benign than even in the recent past?
Yes, to a certain extent. What's happening now is very different from what was happening during the Cold War. So it is true that many people are protesting because their governments have become more repressive and they're taking huge amounts of risk in protesting. And these people are very, very courageous. And in a way that they're having to mobilize because they've got less space and ability to get their grievances into the mainstream political system. But elsewhere, it's almost the opposite. It's because now they've got more space, they've got the technology to organize better, they've learned better tactics, more effective tactics when they take to the street. And in a way, they're taking advantage of increased opportunities to protest. So there are different kinds of protests around the world. This is a very global phenomenon. But the reason it's happening, the reason why there are such large protests more regularly, differ from country to country. So we mustn't generalize too much in the way we try to explain these protests.
But in the way that they look very much the same, even though the causes might be different.
Yes, I think you're right. There are very, very similar patterns. Very, very large numbers of people can take to the streets very, very quickly, apparently without a lot of very formal organization. So protests can erupt very suddenly and unexpectedly. We've seen this in some of the cases that have really hit the headlines in recent weeks and months. And what we see often is that protests are triggered by fairly mundane or fairly specific complaints. Governments putting up the price of bread or removing an oil subsidy or proposing a new fuel tax. Something very, very specific that angers people. People go out onto the streets protesting around that very specific policy. But then the protest seems to take on a life of its own. It expands very quickly in terms of numbers, but also the agenda, also the issues that people are pushing for through the protests. So the very, very common pattern is that protests can start off focusing on quite specific issues, but then they become much more about the system and people wanting to change the whole way that government works or the whole way that an economic system functions.
As I looked over the last few years, and you could hear street interviews with people in all kinds of places, in all kinds of circumstances, nominally protesting for all different kinds of reasons. But it seems like there's a generalized sense that something's wrong, sometimes a something that they can't even put a name to, that they've been lied to, that they're coming out into the streets out of a sense of mistrust of elites or a feeling of betrayal.
Exactly. And that's why what often happens is people put very specific policy grievances on the agenda. Often governments today realize they have to make concessions, they have to change or backtrack on those policies. But now that's not good enough. That doesn't encourage people to go back to their homes and stop protesting, precisely because these protests are the expression of these far broader sense of frustration that somehow governments are just not listening, they're not responsive, people can't get their complaints, their concerns heard in a way that they could before. And that explains why, in a way, these protests end up being against something, against the system, against the inadequacies of the governments they're facing. But as they progress, it's not quite clear what they're actually for, what they're in favor of. And some protesters actually try to make a virtue of this. They say they're not trying to propose specific solutions. They're trying to get governments to realize that there's this broad sense of frustration and unease and discontent amongst the population. So it's ultimately, it's not about tangible policy change. It's about something much more systemic and in a way much more difficult for governments to deal with.
Because no matter how they respond, somebody's still going to be unhappy?
In a sense, yes. Or often because the demands are imprecise, one would have to say sometimes they're unrealistic. Sometimes protesters are putting on the table things that are just not compatible with each other. Often, very, very interestingly, what you find in today's protests is people very strongly on the left actually combining with people on the right. They're in the same protests. They're pressing against the governments, but for very different reasons. They want things that are radically different from each other. So we see typically today in a single protest, people protesting against the capitalist system, others with very conservative agendas, others wanting to kick all politicians and the regime in question out of power, others wanting a far more modest set of policy changes. So there's a great degree of variety in these protests. And in a way, that's why the protests are capable of bringing out so many people today, hundreds of thousands of people typically in protests today come out on the streets, apparently with very, very little notice, very little organizations, and they really catch governments on the back foot, and governments are always struggling then to catch to keep abreast with what protesters are really pushing for.
But that means that even a government that wants to meet some of their demands is in a really tough spot, and that's not to say that all of them do, but many of them aren't even necessarily in such drastic opposition to their own people on the streets. But satisfying their demands becomes hard when they're a little, well, all over the map, which only, it would seem to me, then increases the suspicion of powerful institutions.
That speaks to a very, very difficult challenge, which is that the protests themselves can put governments on the defensive, can seem to be quite effective. But the bigger question is what happens after these protests have happened? And what we've seen over recent decades, the protests can be very large, can be very effective in many ways, but they can also disappear very quickly. And the whole momentum of reform and pressure on governments can often seem to evaporate as quickly as it appeared. So what protesters are trying to learn is how they take the momentum of these protests and then channel it into mainstream politics. And in some cases, they succeed in doing that. In others, they fail. In others, they fail completely. And that's where governments are able to push back with more repressive tactics and basically kind of squeeze this feeling of frustration and protest out of the system through greater repression. In other countries, there's a more successful kind of transmission belt from the protests, from people mobilizing on the streets, into a new type of more open and participative politics. So again, the not only the what's behind the protests, but also the results of the protests differ enormously from different regions and from one country to another.
How has social media changed the game?
Initially, protesters saw social media as being very strongly in their favor. It was what enabled them to mobilize very quickly and effectively. And as you know, many of these early protests, say a decade or so ago, became known as Twitter revolutions or Facebook uprisings. So it seemed at that stage as if social media were kind of intrinsically empowering to the individual and enabling the citizen, the individual citizen, to hold power more strongly to account. The situation now is more complicated. We've seen over more recent years that governments have started to use social media more skillfully to their aims of increasing control over citizens and being able to put down and repress protesters. So there have been some really sobering examples where protesters have been using social media, and that has actually left them more vulnerable to repression from governments that have gradually caught up with protesters in their use of social media. So this now is a very, very live debate. It's leading democratic protesters to rethink a lot of their strategies. And some of them are being a lot more selective in the way that they use social media as their concerns about the negative impact of digital technology become stronger. So I think in the future, we will see that these protests actually do not depend entirely or exclusively on social media. These are not Facebook revolutions or Twitter uprisings. Increasingly, they're taking place through more traditional forms of organization as well, in an attempt to mitigate some of these downsides of social media.
While there's no doubt been this powerful effect that you describe on the organizational side, I'm wondering if also on the thematic, political, persuasion side, social media has had its role to play. Does some of the unease and anger in the United States have a through thread to that in Britain, in France, in Germany, in Hungary, in many other countries where you're seeing kind of a right-wing resurgence, a guy who was a social media star like Steve Bannon traveling across Europe, rallying a new coalition, it appears, of right-wing nationalists?
I think so. And some people would say it's one of the slightly unexpected trends in recent years that many of these rather illiberal organizations or very conservatively motivated protests have actually been amongst the most skillful utilizers of social media. And this isn't just a kind of older part of the working class population. These are very young, educated people mobilizing for what would seem to be quite illiberal, very, very strongly conservative, in a small number of cases, even quite radical causes, and using digital technology very skillful to their purposes. So it comes back to this central point that today I don't think we can say that social media is just on the side of those pushing for greater human rights or greater democracy around the world. Although in many cases, some of the more pro-democratic movements have still been very effective in the way they use this technology. But we're also seeing the kind of backlash to this liberal agenda also being able to use social media. So in a way, social media doesn't push us ideologically in one direction or another. It simply changes the battlefield on which these conflicts are taking place.
In several countries, both right and left have taken to the streets as part of this generalized wave of dissatisfaction. And what kind of choices do you present to a government of the day then? I mean, they can't satisfy all those aspirations when you're talking about large, highly motivated, and very angry groups that want very different outcomes inside the same country.
Yes, many of the demands are incompatible with each other. And as I was saying earlier, many of the protests do contain the full spectrum of political views. Many of these are far left, many are far right. But what's interesting as well is that these protests contain many people who don't identify either with left-wing or right-wing politics. That increasingly, they are including people who have not been active previously in politics. They are new to protest. And they're coming out onto the street because they feel that this is the only way to try and make their voice heard. So it is true, we're seeing a kind of polarization around very leftist and very rightist mobilizations and protests taking place simultaneously. But we're also seeing the emergence of a different kind of protest, which isn't so overtly political. It's about people wanting more kind of practical improvements in their own local communities, better schooling, better health provision. And they're bringing their demands down to a much more local level in a way to try and circumvent the blockages that we see in national level politics. So many protesters today wouldn't ascribe either to these right-wing or left-wing agendas. In a way, they're disillusioned with both these political camps, and that's why they're protesting in a way that is kind of separate from this standard political competition.
A crowd of several hundred thousand people on the street is an amazing thing to watch. And when you get down to street level and you talk to people and you hear what got them there, as you say, sometimes it's very different things that got them there. But I'm wondering if anybody has a good toolbox in this modern age of protest for channeling, for directing, for organizing that person who has heard about a demonstration, heard about a protest, wants to be seen, wants to be counted, shows up, and then what? Can you get a voter card into their hand? Can you get an address? Can you find them again when you need to? Can you turn it into even a party down the road?
I think you hit the nail on the head. This is the Achilles heel of today's protests. Today's protests don't have any problem in mobilizing people and getting hundreds of thousands of people out onto the street. Where they do struggle is to keep this momentum going over the longer term. Because many of the protests are almost anti-politics, it means that when they think they've achieved some of their objectives, the momentum of the protest can disappear quite quickly, and it doesn't translate into longer-term political reform. After the initial wave of a protest, that's where the differences, the divergences between the protesters can suddenly become more apparent. Different factions of the protests can fall out with each other. And these kind of divisions then lead to a situation where governments can play divide and rule, and where then there's a lack of traction, a lack of momentum amongst the protesters in terms of filtering their demands into the political system. So one of the really notable examples of the last decade would be Egypt, where you had a really stirring and very admirable revolution take place, drive an authoritarian regime out of power. But then the protesters didn't really succeed in thinking through a coherent longer-term strategy to get people organized into political parties, to get them to build alliances. And this meant then that the forces of authoritarianism were quite easily able to reestablish themselves in power only a couple of years after that initial democratic revolution had taken place. So I think your question is very, very pertinent. And it's in a way the big challenge that protests face today. Protesters realize that. They're trying to learn. They're trying now at an earlier stage in protests to build alliances with political parties, with non-governmental organizations, with reformers within governments. In many countries, we're seeing that they start off rejecting party politics, but then they do realize they actually need to form new political parties in order to translate their demands into long-term political agendas. So increasingly, we're seeing people trying to bridge this divide between street protests and party politics, on the other hand.
One of the much talked about assumed virtues of these movements is that they are fairly flat. They're not hierarchical. In many cases, they're leaderless. This is portrayed as a strength, a kind of small d democratic, robust strength. But is it really a weakness then, given what you just described as how hard it is to move to the next step?
It's a strength and a weakness, but it's also a little bit of a myth. So many of the protests that start off as leaderless, they do indeed make a virtue of the fact that they have these very flat organizational structures. They don't have the old hierarchies. They're more open and participative. And that does indeed entice more people into the protests. And indeed, it does mean that they are more democratically organized than was the case, say, several decades ago. But the more time that the protest goes on, the more difficult it becomes to maintain any kind of coherence in the absence of firmer leadership structures. So in most cases, eventually these kind of movements do develop leaders. Leaders do appear. Most do eventually put down more kind of formal or firmer organizational structures, because as they realize that they are needed in order to keep the momentum of the protests going. So this idea that protests are completely leaderless, it has a grain of truth, but it's also become a little bit of a myth. In most cases, leaders do appear. Ironically, one of the great paradoxes is that many of the movements that start off as very proudly leaderless end up as being political parties that actually are very, very dependent on one or two very, very high profile leaders. And that's a kind of irony that people still struggle to deal with, when protesters then find themselves linked to parties that are very, very top down and very dependent on one or two charismatic leaders. And it raises the difficult challenge of making sure that these grassroots civic movements actually work hand in hand over the longer term with the new political parties that they give rise to.
In recent past, I was trying to think of examples as you spoke. I covered Occupy Wall Street in various cities where Occupy camps were set up, and Black Lives Matter. And in both those cases, the people who became well-known faces were very much able to articulate the anger that got people on to the streets in the first place. It's not that they were prescribing a program. It's not that they were saying to the vast army of people that were showing up, here, let's go there, because that's where our goals lie. But they were the people who were camera ready or microphone ready. They were the people who were most effective at giving voice to the anger that got people out on the street in the first place.
That was true in the Occupy movement in the US and in the anti-austerity protests that rocked European countries 7 or 8 years ago. And it's true, as I was saying earlier, many of the demands were not particularly precise. Protesters did not want them to be particularly precise. They wanted to expressed this broad degree of frustration, and they thought that if they narrowed that down to one or two policy demands, it would actually take the focus away from these more systemic level grievances. One would have to say in other protests around the world, The dynamics, the motivations are slightly different. In some protests, the demands are very, very specific. They're for a particular president to leave office. They're for elections to take place. They're for a particular development project to stop. So we see the full range. In some protests are a general cry of kind of exasperation with the system. The demands are very imprecise. But at the other end of the spectrum, some of them have very, very specific policy goals and don't really have this system level element quite as prominent in their motivations.
So does the eventual audience, the end user of the message, if you will, change with the cause? Because if you are out on the street because you just can't make a living, which was the spark that set the fire in the Arab Spring in many capitals. If you are out on the street because a despot has been in charge for forever, your whole life in many cases, and you just want him to go, are the end users different? A lot of people only see protests because they see them on television. A lot of people see protests because they're trapped in their cars as a march shuts down a major highway or a square or intersection in a city. Who you're talking to change with what you're trying to say?
Absolutely, because in a lot of these countries, the end user is not just the government. It's not, these protests are not just about pressing the government into certain concessions. The protests also aim to try and mobilize society more generally. They realize that a couple of 100,000 people, as impressive as that is not going to be sufficient to overturn a complete political system, and that protesters need to get the broader society engaged as well. And so they're speaking to the broader range of people who perhaps haven't been very active in opposing these kinds of regimes before. And in some cases that works. The broader range of society gets involved, but in other cases it doesn't. So in many countries, you see months and months of protests, well-designed protests, well-organized protests, very innovative, very courageous protests taking place. But governments, even though they seem to be put on the back foot, manage to maintain themselves in office. So we see some really spectacular successes, governments being pushed out of office in Brazil and Zimbabwe, Korea, Ethiopia last year, Korea, a wide range of cases. But equally, we see protests, very, very large scale, very persistent, often failing, and regimes being able to defend themselves in office. In countries like Hungary, Uganda, the protests in Hong Kong didn't succeed, or Turkey, Iran, of course, big protests last year. So again, we can find the full spectrum of the different end users responding in very different ways. Some leaving office, some implementing some degree of policy reform, and in some cases, governments responding with increased repression.
We've been hearing from Richard Youngs of Carnegie Europe. He's in conversation with Ray Suarez on the topic of the power of protest. After the break, join us for the second half of this conversation. Thank you. You're listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. This program is produced in association with KQED Public Radio and the Aspen Institute. I'm Jane Wales, your host. We're hearing from Richard Youngs. He's a senior fellow at Carnegie Europe and author of the new book, Civic Action Unleashed. Moderating the program is my co-host, Ray Suarez. To hear this program or any other, you can download our podcasts on our iTunes channel or wherever you get your podcasts. Search for World Affairs, that's one word. And now back to our program.
Is there a risk when you head out onto the streets that while enlivening, turning on, engaging people who agree with you, you may also alienate, turn off, embolden, or organize people who don't agree with you?
Yes, I mean, in many countries, you can see a backlash against these protests. But at the same time, I would say that perhaps the bigger risk is that the protests raise expectations to almost unrealistic levels. So they're very successful in enthusing people and getting people out onto the street, making people believe a different kind of future, a different kind of system can be possible. And then as reality hits home and as the promises of the reformers often fail to materialize, that enthusiasm can be easily lost. And in particular, where you have a situation where protest does seem to meet its initial aims, where governments are pushed out of office or they do implement reforms that they'd been resisting before the protests, then as the protesters, the leaders of the protesters themselves can find it more difficult to develop longer term reform plans, then the disillusion can set in quicker today, in a way, because the expectations have been raised to such very, very high levels.
I ask because a feature of many protests now is a perhaps not equally large group, but one that takes the diametrically opposed view, shouting at you from the sidelines or unleashing its own street action, as we saw in Charlottesville, Virginia, when protesters, sort of pro-right, alt-right protesters who were very angry that a Civil War general's statue was being taken down, set up their protest, and then counter-protesters came in huge numbers. The next day, eventually, there was violence.
Yes, I mean, what has happened in the United States is perhaps the most dramatic example anywhere in the world of protests breeding counter-protests and those coming into conflict with each other. But it's by no means the only example. So what you're seeing in the United States has echoes in other countries. Poland would be a good example, where you have very large protests against a very illiberal, some would say almost undemocratic government, and that giving rise to protests in favor of the government on a much more kind of illiberal or conservative agenda. And so this kind of dynamic is becoming more common, and it reflects the fact that these very existential political battles are often moving out of mainstream representative democratic channels onto the streets. So it reinforces the point we've been making during the interview that the protests are not just about one ideology. They're not taking us just in one political direction. They constitute a new battlefield of civic mobilization, where people with different ideas of the good society, the good political system, are increasingly coming into conflict with each other. Having said all that, one caveat would be that even though we're seeing these really large-scale protests taking place in the US and across the, more or less the whole world today, we are still talking about a situation where most people are not engaging, most people are not mobilizing. And in some countries, the repression is just too great for people even to risk going out onto the streets at all. So this is becoming a much more important element of global politics. But there are still places where protest is either not possible or very small numbers of people show any real commitment or interest in mobilizing against their governments.
But if you're sitting at home in your sparsely furnished apartment, listening to a demonstration over a crackling radio in the kitchen, you may be convinced that the change that was promised when democracy came, the change that was promised after the fall of the bipolar world that began with the crumbling of the Berlin Wall, that those promises have not been kept to you. And now here are people who are articulating that, even though you're not out on the street, you're sitting having tea in your kitchen. Are there people who are brought along whose own sentiments about a breaking of the social contract, of a government that's unresponsive or simply ignoring the needs of the working poor or the middle class? Are you pulled along, even if you're not a person who's going to show up and face a police line?
Absolutely. And you raise a very important category of protest. That there are protests in the advanced democracies, many of which are organized around identity issues. And then there are protests in very authoritarian regimes, which are more directly about trying to get an authoritarian regime out of office. But then there's a kind of middle category of countries that have made some of the journey towards being democratic. They had very, very high expectations in what democracy could deliver. Those expectations were not fulfilled. So people find themselves in a political system that is formally democratic, but really not meeting their aspirations. And this is a category of country where we've seen protests become particularly widespread. It's people feeling betrayed in a way with the promises that the democratic leaders made to them. And it's that the strength of that frustration that is driving people out onto the street. And in a way there, you almost have a perfect storm, because in those kind of countries, they can easily go to the street because there is at least a modest degree of political freedom. But at the same time, the democratic system is not delivering to any significant extent what people wanted from that system. So people have both the motivation and the opportunity to go out and protest. So what you refer to there is becoming a very, very prevalent type of protest we see around the world.
It seems that the aspirational class of the world lower middle class, let's say, and the poor, were promised certain things from globalization that it took a while to realize they weren't happy with. It didn't happen all at once. It didn't happen just for one reason. And they were reassured by their own leaders, weren't they, that things were going to get better, but you had to give it time. Why is time up in so many places? Why is a delayed fulfillment of the promise so irksome, so angering now, when it might not have been several years ago?
People have been waiting a long time for the benefits of globalization to trickle down. Often in these cases, there's a very specific kind of trigger for protest. But what we've seen is the general sense of frustration has grown. Countries reach a kind of tipping point of discontent. It's not easy to predict when that tipping point will be reached. There's many, many different factors that determine the precise timing of when a particular protest takes place. It's very, very interesting that most of these protests, we all know analytically something is wrong in these kinds of societies and with people's feeling of disillusionment with governments. But it's very, very difficult to predict exactly when that will express itself through large-scale street mobilization. So in the examples we've been talking about, almost no one actually predicted with precision when a particular protest would take place. And the protests always seem to come as surprise and catch observers and politicians almost off guard. So there's just so many factors involved, political and economic, social, often simple psychological factors, that people become more willing to go out and protest once they see that a critical mass has established itself. So the protests, they develop a kind of snowball momentum. The frustration can build up quite slowly to begin with, But when large numbers of people show themselves willing to go out on the streets, then you as an individual become more likely to go out and join them. And I think it's that kind of tipping point we've perhaps reached in the last 2 or 3 years.
In the Western democracies, there are people who, by the lights of many of the people protesting in the global South, are wealthy. But they themselves, in New York, in Chicago, in L.A., would tell a reporter on the street that they've been left behind, that promises haven't been kept to them. So I guess there's got to be a lot of individual social context. Now that in the United States, very small percentages of earners are taking a huge percentage of all the money being earned in the society, the just be patient, your ship is coming in soon, isn't going to be enough, it seems.
What academic research tells us is that what angers people and drives people out onto the street is a sense of relative deprivation. It's not absolute levels of wealth. It's when people feel that they're being left behind, that other people in their society are doing a lot better, even if in absolute terms their own material conditions may have improved. It's this feeling of being left behind that's really the driver of this kind of frustration. Outside Western countries, the dynamics are a little bit different, because in many rising economies and developing countries, you have people motivated by absolute poverty to protest, but also you have a middle class growing very, very quickly. And as that middle class's material interests more delivered and looked after, they often turn their attention to other things they want, political freedoms, social freedoms. So the middle class in developing countries looks to be doing very, very well, but also can often harbor a great degree of frustration against their governments to do with the lack of political rights and social rights. So they become very, very powerful vehicles for change as well, alongside the sectors of society that have simply been marginalized in economic terms.
One common area in both wealthy societies and poorer ones is in their narrative. When you ask them what's wrong, their kids show up. Now, in a middle-class, mid-American city, it may be kids who can hardly afford to rent apartments, so aren't leaving home or are cratering under the weight of school indebtedness, while in a sub-Saharan country, it may be because the government promised to ease or eliminate school fees altogether for primary grades, and yet has not, keep locking out some of the poorest and most aspirational out of this simple ladder into a better life. Is that one of the moments where you realize that maybe the promises aren't being kept, when you see the prospect of your own kids' future not looking so bright?
Yes, and it points to an underlying factor, which is conflict between generations. Today we see division and polarization, not just between social classes, not between different nationalities, but also between different generations. And we see that, for example, driving the recent very high-profile student-led protests against climate change, or against governments' apparent failure to do anything significant against climate change. Why? Because they feel that the generation of today's leaders has enjoyed all the benefits of economic growth, and they've failed to put in place a new kind of economic model for the future. And the result of that will be significant harm to today's young people. So they're mobilizing against older generations that they think have had the best of the current economic model. And so in a way, this generational conflict now is superimposed on top of social conflict, class conflict, ideational conflict. And we're seeing all these kind of cross-cutting divisions tearing societies apart And once again, driving people to feel that they have to take more direct action in order to get their concerns onto the political agenda.
You've referred a couple of times to protests in the West having an identity part of their profile. And I'm wondering if because British citizens of different classes voted in very different ways over leaving the European Union, the more educated voted to remain, the less educated voted to leave. People in wealthier parts of the country voted to remain. People in struggling parts of the country voted to leave. But also people who were worried about immigration voted to leave, while people who were less worried and said they were enjoying a cosmopolitan Britain voted to remain. It seems to be the textbook case that you could be teaching 10 and 12 and 20 years from now.
And it's a very, very complex case as well. I mean, in the UK, there weren't these kind of large-scale protests before the referendum took place. So the referendum, unfortunately, seems to have created this degree of polarization differences existed before over Britain's relation with the European Union, but nothing compared with this kind of very visceral degree of polarization that we have now. And it's difficult to see that disappearing, whatever happens in terms of Brexit now. But it certainly got people engaged more directly on the European issue. I mean, unfortunately, rather too late in the day, one might say. But I think there the question is whether this mobilization will prove to be a benign and healthy factor for the quality of UK democracy, or if it will become something which is more negative to the whole of the political system. And I think we have to still wait to see which way things will go on that. But in the UK's case, it demonstrates something which one can see across all these different countries, that this is a global trend. There are general trends which affect all countries. There are certain general frustrations that are built up amongst the populations, but the exact form that takes can be very specific to the national circumstances of each country. And we see that in the UK playing out in the context of this debate over Brexit and the relationship with the European Union. In other countries, the frustrations take a very different kind of form, and in other regions as well. So we see this being a very international trend, but expressed in very nationally specific ways. And I think that disjuncture, in a way, will become more and more apparent in the future.
One commonality between the Tea Party movement in the United States, the struggle over Brexit in Britain, and Yellow Vest in France is the core conviction that politics doesn't work and politicians aren't working for me. They have interests that are not my interests. Fair to say?
Fair to say. I think France is the really interesting case there, because President Macron has, as you know, reacted to these protests by offering what he calls a grand debate, a grand democratic debate, where people have been able to participate. People have been able to express their frustrations with the political system. He himself has gone out to local town hall meetings and addressed people. This is very, very welcome. It's very positive, but it raises expectations very, very high now amongst the French people about the kinds of reforms that may result from this process. So I think this will be a very, very interesting experiment for us to follow through and monitor as to whether it is actually capable of dealing with people's frustrations or not. There are already many skeptics in France who say this process of opening up democratic engagement to ordinary people, like Macron has done, is really little more than PR. It won't give, it won't translate into any kind of tangible change. It won't be enough to really placate opposition, Macron's opposition to Macron. Many of the Yellow Vest leaders themselves have dismissed this exercise in bringing the people in as nothing more than cosmetic. So the government in France has got a very, very difficult task to make sure that this new way forward does actually translate into something tangible. But it'd be very, very interesting to see if in the future this is a way of dealing with these protests.
Has immigration thrown an interesting variable into these analyses? You know, if you talk to Americans who supported Donald Trump, if you talk to people who supported Leave in the United Kingdom, if you talk to people in Italy, in France, there's a high degree of anxiety around large numbers of new arrivals, both just plainly put that way, but also about what it does to an essential national character, national personality, national language, the threat that is embedded in immigration. And we saw it in the crisis over arrivals fleeing the Syrian civil war onto continental Europe, a feeling that if we take too many of these people, first of all, there's the strictly economic argument. We've got a lot of our own problems, and we have to solve that first. But waiting in the wings, perhaps in the dark, just behind that charity begins at home argument, this darker, edgier, more anxious argument about who are we and what are we like and will we still be like ourselves if we let all these people in?
Yeah, certainly in Europe, that kind of concern has been very, very high on the agenda, and you've seen protests organized around the migration issue. Those protests have actually succeeded in getting that issue onto the political agenda, and today in Europe, even mainstream parties are now advocating tighter controls on migration. The EU is spending a lot of money on strengthening the EU's borders. I mean, you can argue about whether that's a good thing or inappropriate, whether it's moral or unethical, but it does show an issue where citizens' concerns do seem to have got onto the agenda. What we're seeing now in some countries, at least not all countries, but some, is other kinds of protests organized against that kind of very, as you said, a kind of darker, edgier, illiberal agenda that's become more prominent. So people more on the liberal side, concerned about human rights, concerned about universal ethical standards, organizing against this more illiberal drift.
In 2020, we're going to see a contest that that pits a kind of institutionalist view of government that achieves its highest purposes when it works the way it was designed to work versus one that says, if these things that we've built together aren't working for us, we just have to get rid of them. They've got to go. So respecting precedent and respecting the way things are normally done in a polite and gradual way, I'm tired of that, and I've been betrayed by that, and it isn't working out for me. I wonder if this whole process that we've been talking about during this whole hour actually does damage to democracy, or actually by reminding people that they do have power. Some of it's a negative power that doesn't build or construct anything, but tears down things that are driving them crazy. Whether democracy, when the dust settles, whether people's power, when the dust settles, will be affirmed, or whether these societies, including that of the United States, will be shakier when it's all over.
Yeah, I think that dilemma is well put, because many of these populist leaders and parties, like Trump or the large number of other what we might define as populist leaders across the world, have succeeded because they have a very simple and appealing message, or a message that appeals to many parts of the population, which is that we can undertake a much simpler, more direct form of politics. We can do away with the old complexities. And in a way, that does mobilize people. It gets people more involved in the political system. It offers an alternative. It does offer a genuine alternative to mainstream parties that, as we were saying before, seem to have failed to deliver on their promises for so many years. It offers a kind of regeneration of the political elite. The problem, as it becomes apparent, as these parties get anywhere near power, is that generally they don't have political solutions, the recipes they're offering for people are simply too simplistic to work in practice, or they're contradictory. And I think what we're seeing, and to relate this back to our central theme here of the way that citizens mobilize, is that I think as some of the problems with these more direct or populist forms of politics become more apparent, they're leading other people to mobilize against them. In a way, the populist parties and these kind of very charismatic leaders and parties mobilized more effectively in recent years because they caught the mainstream political establishment a little bit off guard, and they were able to gain ground simply by virtue of being new, by bringing the kind of surprise factor to politics. And I think as people now get used to them being part of the political scenery, so people now on the other side of the political divide are having more time to think through strategies and to organize themselves against these kinds of very nationalistic populist parties. So I think the next stage in citizen protest and mobilization will be about people looking for better solutions to what we've seen with Trump and Putin and leaders, other populist leaders around the world.
Well, let me close here. In that search for a solution, there is a widespread conviction that capitalism hasn't worked for millions and millions of people. And they are, they tell public opinion researchers, ready for something else. Will the disaffection with government have an economic dimension? Do you imagine that in some places in the world, people are just going to demand that their governments rein in capitalism?
I think the protests that have erupted across the world in recent years show that there is a widespread feeling that capitalism has not delivered on everything it promised, and has not delivered on what it promised fairly across the whole range of the population. The trouble is that the perennial question of so what is it to be replaced with? And I think the protests today reflect this very deep sense of frustration against economic inequalities and inequities. But there's still more that needs to be done to work towards actually proposing solutions. And also, it's not just, I come back to this point, it's not just about opposition to the current economic system. That is part of today's protests, but it's not enough to explain them. Part of it is also reflects the fact that democracy doesn't seem to have delivered. It doesn't seem to have given people genuinely equal access to political rights and to human rights. So the political system needs to be looked at. We need some new thinking and experimenting with our form of democratic politics, and not only to look at the economic issues that have driven these protests. It makes it very, very difficult to come to a really kind of comprehensive solution to these revolts and uprisings we've seen shaking global politics over the last decade.
Professor Youngs, thanks a lot. It's been a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. Ours is a nonprofit membership organization. We're dedicated to engaging the public in conversations that matter. Visit us at worldaffairs.org. This program featured Richard Youngs. He's a senior fellow at Carnegie Europe, and he's the author of the new book, Civic Action Unleashed, New Hope or False Dawn for Democracy. The program was moderated by my co-host, Ray Suarez. Next on World Affairs, we'll discuss what motivates Kim Jong-un and what the likely outcome of negotiations will be. World Affairs is produced in association with KQED Public Radio and the Aspen Institute. Our technical supervisor is Jim Bennett. Our researcher is Claire McMahon. Our producer is Jared Sport. And our executive producer is Laura Beatty. I'm Jane Wales. Thank you for joining us.